increased a staggering 165% over the past 12 years. Suicide is the third leading cause of death among young adults between the ages of 15 and 24, behind only accidents and homicide. While more girls attempt suicide, four times as many boys than girls actually succeed in killing themselves. We are losing almost 5,000 teens every year to their own despair in what has truly become an epidemic. In the tight-knit community of Evansville, this epidemic of suicides became shockingly real last year. In October 1997, James Scally walked inside his house to find his 17-year-old son, Kurt, hanging from his closet railing. Shocked and horrified, James and his wife were completely unable to answer the question, why? Kurt was a warm, friendly, sandy-haired boy who was popular with his buddies and with girls. Recently his life had been going well. He had landed a job he wanted. He had a girlfriend he liked. Some parts of his life were less rosy. His brother had been arrested recently and was being held without bail on a charge of robbing the local grocery store. Kurt had been caught in a minor accident after uncharacteristically driving drunk. Still, it didn't seem to add up to the kind of sadness that drives a boy to suicide. How, his family, friends, and the entire community wondered, could he have done this to himself? Kurt was part of a string of suicides in Evansville that summer. He was the eighth teenage boy to take his life in the span of only 6 months, while during the same time another 65 or so young men from the neighborhood had attempted suicide and had been treated in local hospitals and clinics. Some blamed the deaths on the hard times in the neighborhood. Evansville, a clannish, tight-knit community of Italian-American families, had once been a source of pride for them and now had fallen on hard times. What hadn't changed was the community's belief in a code of tough masculine behavior and its pride in the boys who excelled at that code. An uncle of one of the suicide victims described how he had taught his boy to be a real man. He said, "I taught him not to back down. Stick up for yourself. Don't let anyone push you around. If you can't hit them with your hands, pick up something and whack them with that." Sadly, this boy and the other suicide victims must have faced demons that couldn't be whacked with sticks, demons that they had no tools for combating. Apparently, Kurt had told a friend the day before, "I wish life would end." Kurt had tried to communicate his agony, yet sadly it went unheeded. Part of the problem is that boys don't know how to communicate their despair. Kurt's statement, "I wish life would end," the day before his suicide, was something that could be passed off as hyperbole, a remark with no more emotional weight than the common expression, "life sucks." Certainly Steve, before he descended into a life of drugs and school failure, never told anyone he was sad about his dog's death. By adolescence, boys have submerged their feelings so well they are no longer in touch with them, and therefore don't know how to ask for help, even when they most desperately need it. Boys' depression. What are we to do? To prevent our boys from drifting away from us, I believe it's important to take proactive steps to help prevent tragedies like those described. Be alert about your boys' friendships and relationships. Try to know how their relationships are going. Take the lead and try to break through the silence about relationship talk. Ask your son whom he spends time with, who his friends are, how he likes his teachers at school, how he's feeling about his siblings. if he feels that everything is going well with you. Strong relationships can prevent boys from sliding into despair or risky behaviors in the first place. Boys need to feel connected to significant people who care about them, who make time for them, and who listen to them. This is among the best protections we can give our boys. Be watchful for signs of depression and intervene early. One of the worst kinds of family tragedy occurs when the signs of depression are present, but nobody sees them or acts upon them. When you notice your boy exhibiting any of the behaviors associated with depression, or if your boy just seems to be a little bit down, don't waste a moment before asking him what's going on with him. Intervene early. If he lets you know he needs some time before talking, give him that time. But keep yourself available for talks, and when he's ready, listen to what he says empathically. Tell him stories about your own experiences, feeling sad or disappointed, and how you were able to cope with these situations. Let him know that you care, that he's a good person, and that you'll always be there for him. Don't be afraid to consult with a therapist. If it seems as if your boy's symptoms aren't going away, don't be afraid to consult with a therapist. Many times, parents don't feel comfortable approaching a therapist because they're afraid they might be overreacting and fear they'll embarrass their boy by suggesting therapy. If you develop these kinds of reservations, contact the therapist yourself and see whether he or she might meet with you separately first to hear about your boy and his situation. I would strongly recommend that therapy for boys be conducted with someone who not only appreciates children's or adolescents' needs in general, but who also understands boys' needs in particular. A therapist must be sensitive to the shaming culture that boys grow up in, and be sure not to further shame the boy. At best, a therapist can provide a boy with a new, safe relationship in which he can continue to grow and develop. If a boy's depression is severe, medical intervention may be necessary. When a boy's depression becomes severe, I would certainly suggest consulting with a psychiatrist knowledgeable about intervening with appropriate medications. More and more frequently, doctors are prescribing antidepressants to young adults and children when appropriate. Some studies suggest that the newer antidepressants, such as some of the SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, may be effective in cases of serious clinical depression. Medications can be a huge benefit to a boy sunk in the depths of clinical depression. But it's important to realize that medicating a boy is rarely enough. Therapy with the psychiatrist who is also trained in such specialized counseling, or with a psychologist or other appropriate mental health clinician with such training, is also needed to ensure that the boy understands the problems that led him to depression and learns how to detect the early signs of these problems if they recur. Try to address the big picture. It's critical that we try to understand our sons in the larger context of what their lives are like at home, at school, and in society in general. It's so easy to think that a boy who becomes sad or depressed is somehow to blame, that somehow he's not a real boy or a good boy. But in so many cases, the problem goes beyond the boy himself. He may be being bullied. He may be struggling at school. His friendships may not be working out well. Perhaps he's dealing with parents who don't get along or who have their own troubles. Perhaps he's getting teased because, in one way or another, he's not quite following the boy code. To help boys conquer sadness and avoid depression, we must be sure to look at the big picture. It's not enough just to know the boy and his behaviors. We need to find out what his life is really all about. So in addition to asking him about his relationships, try to find out what his days at school are like. Does he enjoy his classes? Are his teachers fair to him? Do the other students treat him well? Has he had any disappointments recently? What does he do after school? Does he feel fulfilled? Is he lonely? Also, find out whether biological factors might be contributing to a boy's unhappiness or depressive state. Inquire whether there's any family history of depression. Because some studies have shown that a vulnerability to depression may actually be inherited, figuring out whether a pattern of depression exists within a family is a logical step to assessing the possibility of depression in a child. Even if such a pattern does not exist, it's also important to consider that internal biological factors, for instance, an imbalance in certain neurotransmitters in the boy's brain, may be leading to the change in his behavior more than something intrinsic to his personality or to his life experiences. Determining whether such a chemical imbalance may exist obviously requires consultation with a knowledgeable clinician. In addition to looking at these biological aspects, we need to ask appropriate questions about what the boy's family life is like. Do his parents get along? Are both his parents living with him, or are they separated or divorced? Does he have a close relationship with both his mother and father? Do they both treat him well? Is there any possibility of abuse or neglect in the household? Does the boy have siblings? If so, does he get along well with them? Do they treat him with love? Have there been any recent major traumas or losses in the family? A chronic illness, an accident, a divorce, a death? Have any of the boy's siblings or one of his parents recently suffered depression or other psychological disturbances? By probing behind the mask to learn as much as we can, not only about our boy's inner emotional world, but also about all aspects of his daily life experiences at school, on the playground, and at home, we begin to understand the many factors that may be contributing to his sadness or depression. Since only rarely is a boy's unhappiness or depression caused by something entirely within himself, it's critical that we see the big picture and address all of the conditions, internal and external, that may be bringing him down. Stay on top of the facts about depression and talk about them openly. Finally, try to keep informed about depression and encourage others who care for your boy, especially teachers and adult youth leaders, to learn more about these issues. If yours is a two-parent family, make sure your spouse participates in the learning process. Once your children are old enough, explain to them that you understand how sad life can sometimes be. As adults, it's not unusual to feel as though it's inappropriate to talk to children about things that aren't happy. Yet having honest talks about how tough and disappointing things can get is important. So talk about the mask. Talk about gender and the straitjacket. Talk about how society can be unfair to boys. By letting young people know that life isn't always so easy, we set the stage for honesty and open the door for sharing emotions without embarrassment or shame. Following each of these steps is just the beginning for helping boys overcome pain and ward off depression. Though they may not guarantee that a boy will always be happy, these strategies can surely help him through some of the tough times. And they may make the difference between life and death. Chapter 12. Hamlet's Curse: Depression and Suicide in Boys. There's a mold you should fit into if you're a guy. You're supposed to be on the strong, aggressive side, have social strength and strength of will and strength of body, You can't break like a twig in the wind. Mark, age 15. The Hidden Epidemic of Boys' Depression. Duncan Kasner and his mother both appeared surprised when I first said the word depression. Tall, lean and athletic-looking, with large brown eyes and stylish-looking wire-rim glasses, Duncan, at age 16, probably would not have fit anyone's stereotype of a depressed human being. "He's getting into all sorts of trouble at school," his mother, Jocelyn, explained, before sending Duncan to see me. "He's cutting classes and coming home early, and he tells my husband and me that he's been getting bad headaches. When the school called me to complain and I asked Duncan what was going on, he told me he thought he had a problem with migraines. But when I get home most days, he's always in his room playing around with his computer. His grades are dropping, and I want to see him succeed like his older brother Graham, who's a freshman at Bates. Duncan's always been such a good kid, and we just really can't figure out what's gotten into him." Duncan and I began to meet shortly after my phone call with his mother, after his family doctor had ruled out any physical basis for his headaches. "Maybe you could tell me a little bit about the headaches," I asked Duncan during his third visit with me. "Lots of times at school, by the afternoon, my head hurts. It starts killing me. I can't take it, so I go home, lie down, and just fall asleep. Then I usually surf the net or just watch TV." "It sounds kind of lonely," I suggested. "Nah, not really. I'm a loner anyway. I don't really like many people. I'm just as happy doing my own thing. I'm sort of the independent type." And then I seemed to say the magic words. "What was it like when your brother was still around? I understand he's off at college now." "Who, Graham? Well, Graham used to be, like, one of my best friends. But he's older than me." "Do you miss him?" "Not really. I mean, yeah, sort of. Maybe at school." Duncan seemed uncertain, deeply confused. "You mean school's not quite the same without him?" Duncan began to cry. In fact, he cried so heavily, his words became almost incoherent. He used to help me." "Help you deal with the other kids?" I asked. "No, not with the other kids, with the teachers." "What do you mean?" "Well, they always give way too much homework than you can get done. And then I start messing things up. I make mistakes in spelling. You see, I'm dyslexic, and so I have some problems at school."
"Dyslexic?"
"Yeah."
"So Graham helped you?"
"Every afternoon, he'd go over my homework with me and make sure I understood my mistakes. And then in the afternoons, we'd hang out together."
"Do your parents know that you're dyslexic?"
"Yeah, but they don't like to talk about it. And they never knew how much Graham helped me."
As our discussions continued, I learned that Duncan had been diagnosed with dyslexia just 4 years earlier. Since he came from a family with two incredibly driven, highly successful parents and a talented older brother, apparently his disability was discovered rather late and was still hardly discussed. Both of his parents had basically kept his dyslexia a secret from the outside world. It turned out that in addition to skipping classes and developing bad headaches, Duncan had developed serious problems with sleeping that were making it close to impossible for him to concentrate at school. His energy level had dropped enormously, and teachers reported that he often seemed irritable. Unbeknownst to either him or his parents, Duncan was significantly depressed. Yet because he hadn't come home and opened up to his parents about his difficulties at school, because he had not really told them how much he missed his brother Graham, Duncan simply seemed to them to have developed problems with his behavior. "Duncan is just acting out, isn't he?" asked Jocelyn. "Actually," I answered, "I think he may be somewhat depressed. I recommend we continue talking, and in addition that we seek consultation with a psychiatrist to see if he might also benefit from a short-term intervention with appropriate antidepressants."
"You've got to be kidding me," his mother replied incredulously. "You're not telling me my Duncan is clinically depressed, are you?"
"Well, yes, I think he may be."
"This isn't a common problem with boys his age, is it?" she then asked.
"It's not as uncommon as you might think," I explained. "In fact, recent research tells us there may be at least as many boys who are depressed as there are girls who are depressed. And that means there may actually be millions of depressed boys out there, many of whom may not look depressed on the outside."
"It sounds like a hidden epidemic," offered Jocelyn.
"I think you may be right," I said.
Big boys don't cry. Of all the cultural prohibitions that limit our boys, I have found that one of the most unrelenting is the taboo against expressing sadness. It's so common as to be a cliché. "Big boys don't cry," boys are told. "Get over it. Snap out of it." Though every boy naturally feels sad from time to time, boys learn early on not to cry or talk about sadness, and not to turn to others for help. The boy code enforces these restrictions. Our male cultural icons reinforce them, too. It's hard to think of Michael Jordan, Muhammad Ali, Tom Cruise, Bruce Willis, Arnold Schwarzenegger, or John Wayne expressing feelings of personal sadness in public. The typical action hero underscores the idea that tough men don't get sad, they just get even. The hero finds his enemies have burned down his home, his car's tires are slashed, and his friend has been slaughtered. Does he scream, weep, or collapse? No, he glares off into the distance, and the only sign of emotion is a tightening muscle in his cheek, the growing fury in his stony gaze. Then he bursts into action, leaping into a high-tech vehicle and roaring off to seek revenge. Because society trains boys to cover their sadness, it becomes very difficult for others to know when a boy is not doing well emotionally. Add to this the fact that we generally do not expect boys to be sad or depressed, and the fact that if we do suspect depression in boys, we often use inappropriate methods of diagnosis originally designed to ascertain depression in adult women. And it should not be surprising that we frequently have a hard time realizing when our sons are unhappy, and often fail to detect or to accept depression when it occurs in young and adolescent boys. By depression, I mean the disorders that range from dysthymia, which is something like being in a very bad mood a lot of the time, up to and including what is generally referred to as a major depression or a clinical depression. Another form of depression is what psychologists call bipolar disorder or manic depressive illness. Since many of the symptoms in this disorder overlap with the symptoms we discuss in clinical depression, much of our discussion of how to detect and treat depression in boys will also be helpful to anyone trying to detect these and other forms of depression as well. As reflected in Duncan's story, when parents first learn that their sons are unhappy or clinically depressed, they are often utterly surprised. "We had no idea he felt that way," they say. "He seemed so withered and upbeat." Or, "We knew he seemed grouchy and tired a lot, but we thought it was just a normal teenage thing." A boy can be severely depressed, even suicidal, and his parents may not be able to tell the boy's troubled state. Learning to uncover whether a boy, especially a young boy, is merely discontented or is actually depressed can be quite difficult. It's hard to discern a boy's feelings of sadness or vulnerability, and the line between short-lived unhappiness and clinical depression
is sometimes hard to make out. Take, for instance, 8-year-old Devon Washington. Large for his age, Devon was sent to see one of my colleagues when one of his teachers discovered that he was hitting his playmates during recess each day. These weren't everyday playful taps, but truly forceful, injurious punches. The teacher realized there was a problem when another boy came to her and revealed a large black and blue mark on his upper arm. The teacher told my colleague, "Devon is not doing well in our school. He doesn't listen in class. He's very aggressive, acts out a lot, and now is punching other kids. We think he may be hyperactive." The teacher's proposed diagnosis was plausible. Devon was inattentive in class, was not doing well in his homework, and now had begun to direct aggression toward other students. But it turned out, according to my colleague, that Devon was actually depressed. He did not exhibit any of the classic symptoms we generally associate with depression. For example, he wasn't quiet, melancholic, or withdrawn. He wasn't weepy. He wasn't expressing despair or hopelessness. Instead, Devon was rebellious and full of rage. He resisted doing his schoolwork, acted defiant and distracted, and now was lashing out at others. It was only through the prescription of cognitive behavioral therapy and appropriate antidepressant medications that Devon was able to overcome his illness. The many faces of depression. Depression affects boys in a variety of ways. It may make them feel sad, anxious, or numb. The depressed boy may act sullen and withdrawn, or, like Devon, may become agitated, overly aggressive, and full of rage. He may misbehave in school or become dependent on drugs or alcohol, or he may just seem glum. Depression in boys is a syndrome involving a whole range of behavioral difficulties and symptoms. While just about any adult who's been diagnosed with clinical depression will tell you that the experience is quite different from a bad mood, it's essential, especially in the case of boys, to see depression as this kind of wide-ranging syndrome with symptoms that fall along a continuum from mild to extreme. I believe that if we dwell merely on the most extreme and obvious instances of full-blown or clinical depression, we risk failing to help boys cope with emotional states that, though less intense on the surface, are actually very painful for them. Emotional states that, without appropriate intervention, may very well evolve into a major depression or provoke suicidal feelings. There's also a risk that by ignoring certain related behaviors, most notably irritable conduct and the abuse of substances, we may also fail to recognize the onset of a serious depression. The biology of depression. We now know that in addition to psychological elements, depression can often be caused by biological factors, most notably by an imbalance in certain neurotransmitters, such as serotonin, that seem to directly affect emotional well-being. Medications that correct these imbalances, so-called SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, such as Prozac, fluoxetine, Zoloft, sertraline, and Paxil, paroxetine, have been shown to be helpful to many people, including children, suffering depression. But neurotransmitter levels are also affected by psychological phenomena, such as daily stress, loss of a loved one, or an early trauma, all of which may change the biological and chemical workings of the brain, leaving it vulnerable to depression. Exercise levels can change neurotransmitter levels in a different way, improving your mood and your biology. We are just beginning to understand the complex interrelationships between the biological and psychological aspects of our emotional systems. As with the heart, some people are born with a genetic predisposition to heart disease. They inherit a weak heart, high blood pressure, or a tendency to atherosclerosis. Such individuals will have to work hard to prevent heart disease. But heart disease doesn't have to come about through genetics. If a previously strong heart receives enough abuse, a poor diet, chronic smoking, or habitual lack of exercise, it will become vulnerable to a heart attack. Likewise, depression seems to run in some families, but a vulnerability to it can be created at any point through early deprivation, a lack of healthy, loving relationships, or repeated blows to one's self-esteem. While I believe the biological or organic components of clinical depression and the medical treatments for them are of paramount importance and need to be carefully studied, my primary focus here is on what other psychologists and I have discovered about external psychological factors that can lead boys towards serious sadness or depression. Factors such as a boy's family life, how he's treated at school, the quality of his friendships, and what kind of emotional support he gets on a regular basis. The cost, again, of society's disconnection. In my view, so many of the symptoms of depression that boys experience are caused by gaps in how we as a society address the inner emotional worlds of our boys. As discussed in earlier chapters, boys are often pushed too early to be independent of those people, their parents, who have so far been their main source of comfort and nurturance. I believe that the pain of being separated from and losing these people, in and of itself, is enough to depress just about any boy. While neither the trauma of premature separation nor abandonment leads all boys to become depressed, either may create a deep sadness in many boys, making them vulnerable to depression later, either as boys or as men. Further, I believe that many boys become susceptible to depression because of the emotional scarring they receive through society's shame-based hardening process. No matter how healthy a boy's emotional system was when he started life, it quickly becomes compromised by the hardening he feels is necessary to avoid feelings of shame, and by his denial, because of shame, of vulnerable emotional states such as sadness, disappointment, and despair. Every boy needs to cry sometimes, to seek the comfort of loving arms, to tell someone how much he hurts, and to have them respond with empathy. Yet because of the gender straitjacket that inhibits boys from ever completely experiencing these feelings, let alone expressing them, and insists that they don't need help, boys actively repress feelings of sadness in an unhealthy way that can lead them to feel lonely and frightened, or push them toward more severe forms of depression. But the straitjacket also brings about sadness and depression in boys in yet another important way. As we've discussed, our gender-stereotyped myths about boys mislead us to believe that boys do not care much about their relationships with friends and families, and that boys are generally tough, cocky, and independent. Yet we've also learned that in reality, most boys experience all sorts of insecurities, feel tremendously dependent on their friends and families, and in many areas, for example at school or when dating, are prone to large fluctuations in self-esteem. Boys yearn for connection. They care a lot about their relationships and about how they are liked by others. But because we are so often confused by the old myths, we may tend not to pay attention to the emotional ups and downs in our sons' friendships and relationships, and thus be unaware of the devastating feelings of shame our sons may experience when these friendships or relationships are not going well or have come to an end. Such shame in a boy, if no one detects it and explores it with him, can lead him to feel profoundly sad, afraid, and disconnected from the rest of the world, and even to become clinically depressed. Depression over relationships. Yet researchers, have perennially doubted the intensity or basic emotional importance of boys' relationships, and so have assumed that problems in them would be unlikely to cause boys to become sad or depressed. Thus, a study on depression in adolescent boys and girls, conducted by Joan Jirgus and her colleagues at Princeton University, hypothesized that levels of depression in early adolescent girls are more closely related to their popularity with peers than in early adolescent boys. An assumption based on the frequent argument that women are more likely than men to base their self-esteem on their relationships with others and on the approval of others. But the results of the study were not as expected. Surprisingly, the boys' depression scores were significantly correlated with both popularity and rejection, whereas the girls' depression scores were only significantly correlated with rejection. Thus, girls and boys are apparently equally vulnerable to depression as a function of poor peer relationships. Another study by Paul Rode, John Seeley, and David Mace in Eugene, Oregon, also found that boys suffer when they don't have healthy relationships. This study focused on the extent to which delinquent adolescents develop ideas about suicide, and it found that boys were more likely to think about suicide if they were suffering stressful life events and if they lacked social supports in situations such as when they were lonely and had few close relatives. The authors concluded that suicidal behavior for boys is closely linked to their social connections. We now know that the opposite is also true, that strong relationships can prevent boys from sliding into depression or engaging in risky, self-destructive behaviors in the first place. The National Longitudinal Study on Adolescent Health, also mentioned in Chapter 7, found that teenagers who felt connected to their families were less likely to experience emotional distress. They were also less likely to engage in violence, attempt suicide, or use harmful substances. The key factors were parents who shared activities with teens, who were physically present at key times during the day, and, most important, who expressed warmth, love, and caring. Also, as we learned in our discussion about adolescence, Blake Bowden at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center found that teens who ate dinner with their parents at least 5 nights a week were significantly better adjusted than classmates who dined alone. In my opinion, we simply must resist being fooled by a boy's mask. Boys are not lone rangers, and at all ages they need to be told that they're good, that they make good friends, that they're needed and loved. And like all human beings, they particularly need caring support when their relationships are disrupted or come to an untimely end. Changing rates of depression. It's a guy thing, too. Perhaps one of the main reasons we often fail to detect and thus to treat depression in boys is that depression has been seen as something that girls and women suffer far more often than boys and men do. The reality, however, does not seem to follow our gender stereotyped assumptions. Some 3.5 million children under the age of 19 are clinically depressed in this country, about 5% of children in that age group. According to IMS America, a research company, some 580,000 prescriptions for Prozac, the most popular antidepressant drug, were written for children ages 5 and older in 1996. In studies conducted in 1990 and 1991, Professor Susan Nolan Hoeksema and her colleagues at Stanford University found that from ages 8 through 12, more boys reported depression than girls, and that these boys' scores for depression were consistently higher than those of girls. Interestingly, these Stanford studies reflected that the most important symptoms of depression in prepubescent boys were behavior disturbances, such as being irritable or misbehaving, and anhedonia, a lack of pleasure, especially in relation to friends and friendships. Of course, these kinds of symptoms, taken alone, would not generally qualify for a diagnosis of depression. This helps to explain why many boys, especially older boys who may display only these kinds of symptoms, could easily have their depressive states overlooked or misdiagnosed. In one of the largest studies of depression in children, a survey in 1982 of 2,790 children in rural Pennsylvania, Smucker at Penn State found that there were no differences in the numbers of boys and girls who were depressed, nor in the severity of their depressions, suggesting that girls and boys may be equally susceptible to depression. In another poll of 1,000 teenagers, conducted for Ms. Magazine in 1997, 28% of young women aged 15 to 21 stated they feel depressed daily or several times a week, and 20% of young men in the same age group reported to the magazine that they feel depressed just as frequently. These studies on the incidence and severity of depression in boys are staggering. It's quite probable that many of the studies may actually underreport the incidence of depression in boys, especially among older boys, because of boys' reluctance to confess to sadness or vulnerability. Because boys feel pressured to mask their genuine pain, many boys, in the context of psychological studies or surveys, may fail to admit or even know that they're experiencing depression. This has already been shown to be true of men. Angst and Dobler-Mikola, in Switzerland, found that men and women who are depressed report their problems very differently. The men tended to minimize their pain. The researchers started with depressed men and women whose emotional problems had caused them similar levels of impairment at work. One could assume that these men and women were suffering similar levels of emotional pain, yet the men in this group reported far fewer symptoms of depression than women. Angst and Dobler-Mikola also found that, over time, men tended to forget how depressed they had been in the past. Men and women who had the same number of symptoms of depression were interviewed 1 year later. Men recalled many fewer symptoms of depression. Men seemed to actually suppress their memories of a vulnerable, sad time. In a similar way, many boys may tend to deny or forget their pain when questioned by research scientists. While some studies are designed to evoke more candid responses from boys, many, in fact probably most, are not. This can lead to research results that, among other things, end up underestimating the actual incidence of depression among boys. But what's most important, of course, is not to debate which gender is more prone to depression, but to understand that all human beings, despite gender, are all too eminently vulnerable to depression, and that the only way to help reduce the incidence of depression is first to recognize this, and then to learn how to detect symptoms early on and master what to do when these symptoms begin. Recognizing sadness and depression in boys. Learning how to detect sadness in boys is actually a separate process from learning how to recognize an actual depression. While there's a lot of overlap, it's important to distinguish the normal strategies a healthy boy uses to cope with feelings of sadness from the symptoms of an actual depression. So much of the difference has to do with the degree of a boy's behavior, how much he acts a certain way, how intense his behavior is, and how long the behavior lasts. For instance, a boy who occasionally shuts himself into his room when he's feeling down is probably just momentarily feeling sad. By contrast,
The boy who frequently comes home from school goes into his room, shuts the door, and refuses to talk to anyone, is obviously exhibiting behaviors that fall squarely within the continuum of depression. Likewise, a boy who has a bad day and doesn't feel like coming to the dinner table is clearly quite different from one who consistently refuses to eat or dine with his family. Where diagnosing depression in boys becomes more difficult, of course, is when boys' behaviors fall between the temporary bad mood and the comportment of somebody who is obviously unwell. Also, as we've seen, adults may not recognize depression in boys when it is expressed as anger or agitation rather than as sadness, hopelessness, withdrawal, and despair. Sadness, but not depression. Admittedly, recognizing sadness and depression in boys tends to be more difficult than recognizing them in girls. When girls feel sad, they generally rely on a very different coping style than boys. Girls, according to psychologist Susan Nolan Hoeksema of Stanford University, tend to ruminate on their sadness, its symptoms, and its possible causes. Also, research shows that most girls are more likely to cry, admit their feelings of unhappiness, hopelessness, or helplessness, and seek out support from friends and family. In a recent poll, researchers found that when girls feel sad, almost half, 45%, say they talk to friends. Only 26% of the boys polled said they would turn to friends for support. In contrast, when boys feel sad, they do not tend to dwell or ruminate on their unhappiness, and while certainly some will go directly to friends or family for comfort and support, the majority attempt either to simply let go of their painful feelings or instead to take an action-oriented strategy to resolve them. 14-year-old Ross told me how he deals with being sad. "About once a week, I get upset about something, but I forget about it pretty soon. I find a friend and go play ball or just hang out. I put it aside and just move on." Other times, Ross says, he just gets mad. He told me about a time he got in a fight with a friend. "I came home really sad and went up to my room. I just sat on my bed and listened to music. I was sad. Then I got mad, really tense and really mad, and then I yelled and punched my pillow a bunch of times. That's how my sadness is, mixed in with a lot of aggression. Being sad is the same as being mad for me." Ross's response is typical of many boys who cope with mild sadness by distracting themselves. They play ball, hang out with friends, listen to music, or watch TV. When emotions are running so high that simple distraction doesn't work, a boy will tend to withdraw for a while, needing to be alone to ride out the storm, and re-emerging from his sadness only after the worst of the pain is past. Many boys in the Listening to Boys' Voices study spoke of the need to let things blow over. Listen, for instance, to Mark, a bright and energetic 15-year-old. "There's a mold you should fit into if you're a guy. You're supposed to be on the strong, aggressive side, have social strength and strength of will and strength of body. You can't break like a twig in the wind." So how do you deal with things when you're feeling weak, when things aren't going so great? I asked. "When I get angry," Mark answered, "I try to just let it go. I usually try to rationalize it in my head, to explain to myself that I shouldn't be that angry about it. I try to either think about it calmly or not think about it at all, so it won't bother me anymore. When I feel sad, I look for something to throw it into perspective. It kind of goes away, or I concentrate on something else." Because he has internalized the sense that showing too many unresolved feelings can be counterproductive, Mark feels critical of other boys who are unable to keep a lid on their emotions. "Some guys get obsessed with one annoying point in their life, but if they only let go of it, their life would be much better. It wouldn't take them a lot of effort to let go of it. I wish they would just act rationally or calmly, just kind of take it a little quieter and less vocally, like everyone else told them to.
Mark seems to equate expressing his vulnerability with an acute sense of shame, fearing severe penalties for failing to adapt to the mold.
If you don't fit in, then you're a loser, you're worthless, you look stupid, and no one likes you. People tend not to associate with you. They push you off in the corner. After a while, if you respond badly, if you just respond by getting more and more depressed, people don't react well to that.
Mark's comments reflect how any gap in a boy's self-confidence, any admission that he's feeling sad or depressed, becomes a cause for others to reject him. And then again, if a boy continues to internalize his feelings of sadness and pain and doesn't learn how to suppress them, he may fear they're only going to get worse. Mark explains,
"If you try to shut yourself inside your head and not ever come out, then it's just going to be worse. There's no way to get away from it."
But if some boys like Mark deal with sadness by simply attempting to let it go, others rely on the timed silence syndrome we discussed earlier. When a boy feels hurt or unhappy, he may prefer to lick his wounds in private, where he will not be shamed by others. He comes up for air and may seek out help from parents or friends only after experiencing a period of silence and private grieving. The advantage of this strategy for a boy is that no one ever sees his sadness. He averts shame. The disadvantage, of course, is that unless parents know this syndrome when they see it, they may have a difficult time detecting his sadness. My sense is that boys who successfully use distracting and withdrawing strategies, including timed silence, still need other people to help them recover from their emotional pain. After withdrawing to let the worst of the storm pass, most boys go out of their way to reconnect with family and friends. When he's ready to reemerge, a boy needs to interact with others, to play a mindless game of ball with friends, to have mom say, "Glad things seem better," to have dad offer a special trip for ice cream, or even to have the same old argument with his sister about the TV schedule. When this happens, a boy knows that life goes on. His shame melts away. The people who care about him are still around and can be counted on. One 10-year-old boy told us that he could count on his grandfather to help him feel better. After Jim got diagnosed with a serious eye-related disability, he said he was embarrassed to have to wear thick prescription glasses and to have to go to special classes with other disabled children. He started getting really sad, coming home and not talking to anyone, and his grandfather noticed. His grandfather didn't ask what the matter was. He just told Jim to get his coat on. They went to the park and started tossing a baseball, a practice that continued every afternoon for a while. He told me stories about his life, about coming over on a boat and working in a restaurant. He's had a tough life. "It made me feel a lot better," says Jim. Jim may not be able to put it into words, but his grandfather's stories probably helped so much because they expressed the clear message, "We all have hardships that we have to bear. I, too, have felt sad and overwhelmed. I found a way of dealing with it, and you'll get through it, too. We still care about you." When boys have family and friends who offer this kind of sensitive support, they often can get over even difficult situations. The following steps should help when a boy needs some extra attention. Create a safe space. Create a safe space in which your boy can express his feelings openly without fear of being shamed or reproached. Usually this means finding a time when there aren't other distractions, and explaining to the boy that he can say or express anything,
that nobody will judge or punish him for what he shares.
Listen carefully. Listen very carefully to what a boy says. He may not open up immediately, and you might need to just listen patiently until he feels comfortable enough to explain exactly what he's going through. Sometimes the boy may simply not yet be ready to talk. He may still need some private time. If you detect that this is the case, simply allow the boy to take that time and try to be completely available to him, i.e., don't give him half your attention while also doing something else, when he emerges from his silence and seeks your help. Be especially careful about shaming your son. When it's your turn to talk, it's best if you avoid saying anything that might humiliate or embarrass your son. Just about the most helpful thing you can say is that you understand the way he feels and that you are there to help him through in any way you can. Let him know how much you empathize with what he's experiencing. Although sometimes it may seem easier to tease him a bit, to give advice, or to tell him that everything will be fine, these types of responses tend to cut off the boy's ability to express his feelings genuinely. Instead, simply tell your boy that it sounds like things are rough right now. Let him know that you care about the pain he's feeling. In the end, all you need to do is be available, ask thoughtful questions that show that you care, really listen carefully, avoid judgments and lecturing, and express your love and concern genuinely. When things get worse, when a boy sees no sympathy at hand, or if distressing circumstances beyond his control continue, his normal action-oriented coping strategies may become overwhelmed. He may no longer be able to forget his sadness by playing a hard game of hoops, punching pillows, or spending an evening alone listening to music. Attempting to repress his unhappiness and his shame over it may instead thrust him toward turbulent self-conflict, painful emotions jumbling his thoughts and churning his stomach. A young boy may become restless and impulsive, unable to focus, and unable to behave appropriately. He may turn irritable or hostile, expressing his inner confusion by attempting to hurt others, or taking dangerous risks like high-speed driving. He may express the physical aspect of his turmoil by getting sick, having chronic headaches or stomach aches. Or he may withdraw, becoming more and more sullen and estranged from those who care about him. All of these in moderation are normal coping mechanisms when a boy is in pain. But when boys act this way, it's important to look beneath the surface, ask questions, express concern, and attempt to determine what the boy is experiencing. For when these behaviors become persistent or extreme, the boy may very well be on his way to depression. Kenny Robinson, age 16, was fortunate enough to have a mother who recognized that his angry and aggressive behavior was a nonverbal cry for help, and did what she could to bring him back to health. Kenny started seeing a therapist weekly. In these conversations, Kenny was able to let down his mask of anger and express his underlying sadness about his father's leaving home so abruptly. "Nothing's the same without my dad around," he said. "Mom never has time anymore either. She's too busy talking on the phone to her lawyer or her sister." "You feel like you've lost both your mom and your dad?" suggested the therapist. Kenny's eyes filled with tears. "Yeah, I don't know what's going on." His therapist brought Kenny's mother into several sessions and helped her see how much Kenny needed her at this terrible time. Mrs. Robinson was clearly distraught and anxious about the family crisis, but was also concerned about Kenny. The therapist suggested they institute special time, where Mrs. Robinson played whatever game Kenny suggested, as long as it didn't hurt anyone, and with a spending cap if needed. They started with 1 hour a week of special time. Mrs. Robinson had trouble at first getting the energy to follow Kenny's active play, but she saw how important it was to him. Within a few weeks, the two developed a special game. Kenny was a detective who searched for missing persons and sent home good men who had been lost. Mrs. Robinson played her part with increasing enthusiasm. She realized Kenny needed to work through his father's leaving in his own way. She also realized how little she had been telling Kenny about why his father left. Now she made a conscious effort to sit down with him and give him any news she received. They imagined what it would be like to see his father again. She talked to Kenny and helped him sort through the confusing issues. She told him that she knew his father was trying to be a good man, but sometimes people do things that are wrong even when they're trying their best. Kenny and his mother and the therapist also spent 2 sessions talking about how Kenny could stop fighting with other kids. He said quietly, "I fight because the other kids say rotten things about my dad." At this point, Mrs. Robinson started crying and reached over to hug Kenny, who also began to cry. Kenny agreed to try to find ways to talk to kids about his dad instead of hitting them. Over the months of therapy, Kenny's school problems have abated. The family has many rocky times ahead, but at least now mother and son are going through them together. Kenny was lucky that his mother dealt with his angry behavior by sending him to therapy instead of sending him to his room. All too often, a boy's action-oriented coping style confuses the most well-meaning parents and teachers. We take the actions at face value and react accordingly. We punish the angry or impulsive child and medicate the overactive one. We push the malingering boy to toughen up and get back into the swing of things. And, worst of all, we tend to isolate the withdrawn or angry boy. We see his tough, sullen exterior and say, "He's a teenager. What do you expect? It's a phase. He's just being a boy." And so we let him drift away. Some of us may not recognize these signs of sadness in boys, in part because we're eager not to. It's painful to have to admit that someone we love is suffering. It's hard to realize that a boy, whom we prefer to see as tough and strong, can be weighed down by extreme unhappiness. Some parents just accept the outward action behaviors as if they were an inevitable fact of nature, that all young boys act up and that teenagers are rebellious. But behind many of these external displays of boyhood energy and activity are often boys in trouble, boys in pain. The difficulty of diagnosing depression in boys. Diagnosing depression in boys is difficult for several reasons. First, as we've already seen, it's often hard to draw the line between the normal strategies a boy uses to deal with day-to-day hurts and disappointments from the symptoms of actual depression. These symptoms will be described later in this chapter. Second, depression is hard to diagnose in boys because boys so often mask the very behaviors we traditionally associate with depression: sulking, crying, withdrawing. The third, and I believe most important reason recognizing boys' depression is so difficult, is that we tend to look for it using benchmarks more appropriate to girls and women. Some of the classic symptoms of depression in women include becoming weepy, openly expressing hopelessness, helplessness, and despair, showing dependence on others or seeking out and then rejecting help from others. Yet these symptoms are less common in boys, and in fact many depressed boys may exhibit none of them. If we are to recognize depression when it strikes boys, I believe we need to understand the unique constellation of symptoms that occur in boyhood depression. When we comprehend the specific ways in which boys show or mask their unhappiness and other symptoms of depression, It becomes easier to catch depression in its early phases before it becomes severe and difficult to reverse. Consider, for example, 15-year-old Ed, a quiet boy who actively denied that he had any emotional problems or that he was experiencing any emotional pain. When I first met Ed, he sat across a desk from me in a small hospital office, rubbing his head in his hands and saying over and over again, "I don't know how I got here." "You tried to kill yourself," I replied softly. "You took a lot of pills and booze, then tried to use your father's pistol to finish the job." Luckily, the gun had discharged accidentally. The neighbors had called the police, and here was Ed, alive and showing no scars. He smiled wanly at me. "It's a mistake, just a big mistake." But I knew better. In the emergency room, he had upset the doctors by cursing them when he realized he was still alive. This was no mere attempt, and certainly no mistake, but a determined end-run toward death. But unlike some of the girls on this locked ward, Ed showed no outer signs that he had narrowly survived a suicide attempt. He had no slashed wrists, no teary, red-rimmed eyes, no sad, needy look about him. Indeed, Ed denied being depressed. Ed reluctantly answered my questions about his family. He hadn't seen his dad in 3 years, since Dad remarried and had another child. His older brother and sister were getting by on their own. His brother was an electrician, his sister a nurse. He, the baby of the family, was living at home with mother. He was barely passing any of his classes and had been threatened with suspension for truancy. After we worked together for a while, Ed was able to talk about his anger at his family. Brother Greg was drinking heavily and abusing his wife. Dad, also an alcoholic, was flatly refusing to pay child support and refusing to see Ed and his siblings. "I guess the Grady men don't give a shit about the future," said Ed, with his typical half-grin. "I think a lot of young men aren't sure what their future could be," I offered. "Yeah, what's there to look forward to? Life sucks and then you die." As we worked together, it was clear that Ed felt deeply hurt by his father's abandonment. But instead of grieving, Ed learned to put on a false front, to grin and crack jokes. That was easier than pretending he still cared about his father. He had quite a vocabulary around angry words: pissed off, fed up, PO'd. But he vehemently denied he was depressed, and he vehemently denied he needed help. "All I want is a pack of Winstons and a chance to get out of here. I'll be fine." Despite his pain, despite his clear suicidal intent, Ed might not have been diagnosed with depression by a mental health worker who was focused too strictly on current methods of diagnosis, which rely heavily on the criteria in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DSM. In this reference book for clinicians, we find that diagnosing depression is done according to a checklist. A patient must show a certain minimum number of symptoms. First and foremost, he must be suffering a depressed mood or have lost the ability to take any interest or pleasure in the world. In addition, he must suffer at least 4 other symptoms from a list that includes weight loss, sleep disturbances, agitation or retardation, fatigue or loss of energy, feelings of worthlessness or guilt, trouble concentrating, trouble making decisions, and thoughts of suicide. Such criteria are not designed specifically for children and are based on a narrow model of depression, one heavily influenced by the way depressed women tend to behave. According to these criteria, we would have trouble diagnosing Ed as depressed, yet we know that he was so despairing that he was ready to end his life. It's not that the traditional DSM criteria are never helpful in diagnosing depression in boys, for they are. It's just that they're incomplete and do not recognize the broad range of symptoms in boys that we've been discussing. Nonetheless, most mental health professionals currently use these adult criteria to diagnose depression for children as young as 9 years of age. For children younger than 9,